2005 Sunstone Symposium West presents Session 44, Intuition, Quantum Holography, Epigenetics, and the Book of Mormon, a presentation by Robert Reese with a response by Michael Stevens.
Welcome everyone to Session 44, Intuition, Quantum Holography, Epigenetics, and the Book of Mormon. You are brave souls to come to a session with epigenetics in the title. My name is Dan Witherspoon from the Sunstone Foundation. My pleasure to introduce our speakers today. Many of you, one of our respondent isn't here, but I know he's in the building, so I can say whatever he wants until he walks in. But let me go ahead and introduce Bob Reese right now and then his respondent, Mike Stevens. First of all, let me remind you to turn off any pagers, cell phones, noisemakers. Looks like everybody's got a badge. If you don't, please pay us. We need the money. And do all that good stuff that's fun for things. Bob Reese is a literary critic with specialties in American literature, poetry, the short story, literature, film, art. He's also a specialist in research produced by the Institute of Heart Math, which is sort of, I think, the environment through which today's interest sort of came through. HeartMath is an institution that centers on the physiology of learning and performance, including such programs as the Power to Change Performance, Resilient Educator, Test Edge, and the Freeze Framer, which are all kind of just really neat ways to think about learning in a different way than usual. He's taught courses at the university level at UCLA, UCSC, the University of Wisconsin. He's been an assistant dean of fine arts at UCLA, a director of continuing education in arts and humanities there as well, a Fulbright professor. He's now the director of education and humanities at HeartMath and a visiting scholar at the Claremont Graduate University Center for Arts and Humanities. You all may know him certainly from his work. For 5 years, he was the editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought, as well as we were privileged to have him as the chair of the board of Sunstone for a period of time. His respondent is actually the next chair of the Sunstone Foundation. He'll take over for Toby Pringree at our August meetings. His name is Michael Stevens. He's a management professor at the University of University of Missouri, St. Louis, where he's a faculty fellow in the Center for International Studies and in the Center for Nonprofit Leadership and Management. Mike's a wonderful board member. He's got these amazing, internationally known for his ability to, he's developed tests and things that help people know whether they'll work well together on teams and sort of that assessment of personalities and performance and way to build teams. He received his PhD from the Krannert School of Management at Purdue University. He also received there the Ralph Alexander Best Dissertation Award from the International Academy of Management. He's widely cited in his field, and again, we're just grateful to have him at Sunstone and to respond to Bob Reese. So let's go, Bob. Sorry, is that your stuff?
Thank you all for coming. I've been accused of putting my best intellectual and creative effort into the titles of my papers rather than the papers themselves, and this one probably will do nothing to dispel that accusation. Presently, there's an ongoing dialogue, well, more of a shouting match than a dialogue, between apologists and naturalist critics about the origin of the Book of Mormon. Apologists believe the book to be an authentic, ancient, sacred text, while naturalists, contending that it is a product of 19th century America, see it either as a poorly written novel by an unlettered farmer or as a book of, quote, inspired fiction written by an intuitive genius. Each side marshals experts, arguments, and evidence to make its case. Each also accuses the other of misuse of information, selective evidence, ad hoc arguments, and even dishonesty. In a recent article in Sunstone, Dan Vogel asks, is a paradigm shift in Book of Mormon studies possible? Of course, Vogel means a shift away from the apologist position to one based in what he sees as solid scientific evidence. In a response to Vogel, which I recently sent to Sunstone, I wrote the following. until some incontrovertible evidence that truly challenges the Book of Mormon's historical claims, such as a manuscript version of the Book of Mormon written in 1795, it is unlikely that the evidence that naturalist critics have marshaled to this point against the book will be sufficient to overturn the conviction of most believers in the book's authenticity, any more than would current arguments by apologist critics in favor of the Book of Mormon's historicity be sufficient to overturn the conviction of naturalist critics absent incontrovertible proof of the book's historicity, such as finding a fragment of the Book of Mormon text on some stela or metal plates discovered in Central America. In other words, given the present differences and even hostility between those who see the Book of Mormon as historical and those who see it as a product of 19th century American culture, it seems unlikely that there will be a paradigm shift in either direction. In his last book, Rocks of Ages, Science and Religion in the Fullness of Life, Stephen Jay Gould, the distinguished professor of zoology and geology at Harvard, and the author of numerous books on science, argues that science and religion represent what he calls noma, non-overlapping magisteria, or domains of authority and teaching. As Gould says, the magisterium of science covers the empirical realm, what the universe is made of and why it works the way it does. The magisterium of religion extends over questions of ultimate meaning and moral value. Gould suggests that along as science and religion keep to their respective magisteria and respect one another, dialogue is possible. What I propose today is that those magisteria may not really be as non-overlapping as Gould suggests, and that in the realms of new science, there may be space where both empirical scientists and believers can find common ground. According to Robert Nadeau and Menas Kaftos, the tragedy of the Western mind is that we have lived since the 17th century with the prospect that the inner world of human consciousness and the outer world of physical reality are separated by an abyss or a void that cannot be bridged or reconciled. Nadeau and Kaftos quote Alexander Coire of accusing Newton, quote, of splitting our world in two. I've been saying that modern science broke down the barriers that separated the heavens from the earth, and that it united and unified the universe. And that is true. But as I've said too, it did this by substituting the world of quality and sense perception, the world in which we live and love and die, another world, the world of quantity, of reified geometry, a world in which though there is a place for everything, there is no place for man or woman. Thus, the world of science, the real world, became estranged and utterly divorced from the world of life, which science has been unable to explain, or even to explain away by calling it, quote-unquote, subjective. True, he goes on, these worlds are every day, and even more and more, connected by praxis, yet they are divided by an abyss. Two worlds mean two truths, or no truth at all. To bridge these two worlds will require something from both: faith in the possibility that they can be bridged, and openness to new scientific evidence that in some way currently suggests that they are already being bridged. So let us begin. If apologist critics have not paid sufficient attention to some of the sticky problems raised by naturalist critics, so naturalist critics have not been yet satisfactorily answered the question as to how Joseph Smith, or any of his contemporaries for that matter, could have written the Book of Mormon. As Hugh Nibley has stated, and I know as soon as I quote Hugh Nibley, everybody say, Bob Rees is an apologist, but Nibley has a lot of very important things to say. As Hugh Nibley has stated, quote, and of course everyone, including ourselves, has avoided the big question, how did he do it? Nobody was able to explain where he got the book, and to my mind, they still haven't. One of the questions not satisfactorily answered by critics of the Book of Mormon, who see the book as a product of Joseph Smith's mind and imagination and his 19th century environs, is how he could have found many of the elements of the book, for example, knowledge of olive horticulture, Egyptian names and culture, ancient travel routes, knowledge of ancient American culture, extensive and elaborate chiastic passages, etc. where could he have found these in his information environment? If the material was a product of his mind, as some contend, then one has to explain how it got into his mind in the first place. In exactly which books and which libraries did Joseph Smith find or have time to find some of the esoteric and arcane elements in the book? Nobody has really satisfactorily answered that question to my mind. This paper takes a look at new scientific explorations into the possibility that one can access information outside of one's information environment, both past and future, can receive communication across the liminal threshold between the physical and spiritual worlds, and can tap into, quote, non-local information and experience that may exist on the quantum level. This theory posits that Joseph Smith could have gained access to some realm of consciousness that could be characterized as both transspatial and transtemporal, outside of the way in which we normally think of things. What I am suggesting is that new fields of science may provide an answer that could be acceptable to both apologists and naturalist critics and to those who find themselves somewhere in between. If, for example, there really was an ancient American civilization with Middle Eastern roots, is there any scientific explanation that could explain how information about such a people could have been communicated to a bright, spiritually sensitive, and charismatic young man living in Western New York at the beginning of the 19th century? What I am suggesting is the possibility of a way or ways in which material contained in the Book of Mormon could have gotten into Joseph Smith's mind and ultimately onto the pages we read today. It is a possibility to which I hope both apologists and naturalist critics will be open, even though it is based on research that is on the frontiers of scientific exploration. The big caveat. I begin with an acknowledgement that I am not trained in the mathematical or physical sciences, that as a humanist I am limited in my ability to fully understand the fields of intuition, quantum physics, and quantum holography. I take some consolation in the fact that even the brightest of scientists acknowledges difficulty in understanding it. As Amir Akzel says in his book, Entanglement, the Greatest Mystery in Physics, quote, even after decades of research, it is difficult to find someone who will admit to understanding the quantum theory perfectly well. What I offer today is an explanation for the Book of Mormon, which is tentative and speculative, but which is based nonetheless on what I consider sound scientific research. Coming to terms with the Book of Mormon begins with an acknowledgement of the limitations of either science or faith alone as a means for arriving at ultimate truth. All one has to do is to look at the diversity of believers in the world's religion accept as truth based on faith. As important as faith is for those who guide their lives by it, most rational people acknowledge that it is anything but infallible as a single path to truth. So also with science. The history of science is a history of unfolding revelations and continual revisions. Many of the scientific axioms of one generation are overturned by the next generation. For example, those who thought that Newtonian or classical physics provided a complete, ironclad, and even fixed explanation of how the laws of nature worked were shocked when Albert Einstein turned science on his head 100 years ago when he wrote 4 papers that each resulted in deep and formative changes to our understanding of the universe. As Brian Greene writes, the classical conceptions of time, space, and reality, the ones that for hundreds of years had not only worked but also concisely expressed our intuitive sense of the world, were overthrown. Einstein had a colossal mind and a fecund imagination, but for all his brilliance and imagination, Einstein couldn't wrap his mind around the ultimate implications of the scientific revolution he set in motion. He was not able to accept the reality of the door that he had opened into the dark or into the light, calling it spooky. And with good reason. The quantum world is spooky because it demonstrates that the seemingly solid world of physical reality and the seemingly inexorable laws of time and space by which we live and move and have our being are not what they seem. Such concepts are no longer theoretical. As Brian Greene summarized in a recent article celebrating the 100th anniversary of Einstein's discoveries, quote, Decades of painstaking experimentation have confirmed quantum theory's predictions beyond the slightest doubt. Over the past several years, scientists at the Institute of Heart Math, where I work, have been doing some fascinating work on the central role of the heart in human experience. Recent work in the field of neurocardiology has firmly established that the heart is a sensory organ and a sophisticated information encoding and processing center with an extensive intrinsic nervous system sufficiently sophisticated to qualify as a heart brain. Its circuitry enables it to learn, remember, and make functional decisions independent of the cranial brain. Moreover, numerous experiments have demonstrated that patterns of cardiac afferent, that is information that goes up, afferent neurological input to the brain not only affect autonomic regulatory centers, but also influence higher brain centers involved in perception and emotion processing. So in other words, the heart sends much more information to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. And the quality of that information has a great deal to do with our ability to think, to remember, to perform, to be in a coherent state. Let me show you some slides that illustrate their findings about intuition. One of the new areas of research at the Institute is intuition. The findings of HeartMath scientists on intuition were recently published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine in a two-part article called Electrophysiological Evidence of Intuition, Part 1, The Surprising Role of the Heart, and Part 2, A System-Wide Process? These researchers define intuition as, quote, a process by which information normally outside the range of cognitive processes is immediately sensed and perceived in the body and mind as certainty of knowledge or feeling about the totality of a thing distant or yet to happen. So let me show you what some slides suggest about this. Another way of saying this is that there are certain experiences which the body may register before the experience actually occurs in reality.
Can you actually read these?
Yes. Sometimes if a future event is sufficiently important, novel, or emotional, it may precipitate a change in the present physiological state that is consistent with the future reaction. This is a study which has been replicated enough to give us confidence. And when you say us, I don't include myself as a scientist, but as a humanist trying to understand what the scientists are doing. What you have is a computer that has a data bank of pictures that are both emotionally charged in a positive or a negative way. So in other words, you have rattlesnakes and car wrecks and things of this nature on the one hand. You have bunnies and flowers and other images on the other. The people doing this were hooked up with 19 points of on the EEG, also with eye blinking and with HRV connectors. So you're getting both heart and brain reading from these experiments. So what this shows is that the pictures are randomized, so even the computer does not know if you're going to get a positive or a negative picture. So it's completely randomized. One of the things that you see, so you've got a period of 6 seconds and then that happens, and then you've got the picture, and then you have 10 seconds before the next picture comes up. And this will be hard on the tape, but that's what we're going to try to do with. One of the things that you see is that before, if it's a calm picture, this is recording heart rate variability. Heart rate variability is a measure of an averaging of the beat-to-beat changes in our heart. We now know that it is important to have a high heart rate variability, that the old idea that your heart is like a metronome or a clock, if that's the case, you're a candidate for sudden cardiac arrest. It is the variation which is important. So what you have is, if a calm picture is going to come up, and again, keep in mind that the picture comes here. Before that calm picture comes up, the heart reacts in this way. before a negative or emotionally charged negative picture comes up, the heart responds in a very different way. So the picture comes up here, but the heart knows it before it comes up as to what kind of a picture it's going to be. This is a way to show you, in terms of brain scan, what this looks like. You can see that at the point that, and this again, the picture shows up over here. Well before the picture shows up, you have the heart indicating that it's going to be either calm or negative, and 1.3 seconds later, the brain knows it. So the heart knows it, in fact, most likely sends that information to the brain, and the brain recognizes it as a negative or a calm picture. Heartbeat evoked potential. This is, again, a highly technical scientific term, but one of the things you can see here, this is an EEG, so this is connected to the heart. This is the ECG with all of the different points. This is the frontal cortex here. This is the middle part of the brain. This is the pulse. You can see that as soon as this registers, it's immediately, or almost immediately, 1.3 seconds later, picked up in the brain. Then you have slightly later the increase in blood pressure, and that is also reflected in the brain. This one of the things that we were able to determine is that in terms of this, the ability of people to get future information before the information is actually available elsewhere or when it's available in the present, that one of the findings is that women are better at this than men. There's some good news for you, Carolyn. Women are apparently more intuitive than men are. So here what you get in terms of what they call the event potentials of the brain, you get this divergence here. So that, again, you think of these 6 seconds, this huge deceleration, which is what happens when we're seeing something which is scary or threatening or whatever, the heart goes into deceleration. Notice that the heart starts here to do it. A little bit later, the brain does. And what is happening right here, and again, it's before the picture actually shows up, if the brain could talk to itself, it is saying something like, something's about to happen that I need to get ready for. And then it does get ready for it and responds as that picture comes up. This is, I didn't type the right thing in here, but anyway, this will show you this is a difference between the female and the male in terms of the response to a calm picture. There may be reasons for that. Conclusions. Yes? It's a brain. It's going back to it's a brain scan. It shows the energy, the response in the brain. That is, when the heart sends a signal up and the brain is saying something's going on, that's how the brain responds. The conclusion, if these effects continue to be replicated, this would suggest that intuitive processes have access to a field of information that is not limited by the boundaries of time and space. It is difficult to conceive of an explanation outside of a quantum framework. Such intuitive experiences suggest that some aspect of our perceptual apparatus is continually scanning the future. This would imply that the time symmetries commonly described by quantum physicists may also occur at macroscopic scales and in the realm of the human heart and brain. This may be the first evidence that we have that that what is happening on the quantum level may also be happening on the classical, that is, micro to macro level. The heart produces 5,000 times more electromagnetic energy than the brain does. You can measure a person's heartbeat 4 to 5 feet from their body. If we had the instrument, you could measure it a lot further than that. It is this powerful part of who we are that we've been cut off from and that science is now reconnecting us to. Just wanted to show you something which I probably need to hurry on, so I won't talk about this, which is very interesting. 30 minutes, okay, so I have to move on. This is just a way in which somebody's heartbeat is registered. When these people sitting apart from each other reach out and touch hands, this subject A's heartbeat is registered in this person's brainwave. And there's more. Okay, so back to where we were. What are the implications for such findings? Assuming that these psychophysiological effects continue to be demonstrated in future research, they are strong evidence for the idea that intuitive processes involve the body assessing a field of information not limited by the constraints of time and space, as I mentioned. What this research seems to suggest, perhaps for the first time, I'm repeating myself here. Okay, so let's come to what, in relation to the Book of Mormon, it suggests that information about the Nephite nation could have been communicated to Joseph Smith according to some scientific law we do not yet understand. Additional information may lie in studies of quantum holography. As the authors of the intuition study state, more specifically, these findings provide a compelling basis for the proposition that the body assesses a field of potential energy that exists as a domain apart from time-space reality into which information about future events is spectrally enfolded. This concept of spectral enfoldment of information in the interaction among energy waveforms at any frequency provides an information processing bridge between the classical and quantum levels and therefore informs the theory that the interaction between body and the ambient field of energy surrounding it operates as a holographic-like information processing system that informs the body about a future event and, it should be added at least theoretically, about a past event. There's not time to go into the whole business of holography, but one of the things that holography suggests is that everything is in anything, that the universe, there's the idea of wholeness within the universe, and that in each element, each quanta, the smallest bit of information we have, to some extent is the potential for all of that in the world. I'm going to do another very quick demonstration of how holography works, and again, keeping in mind that I'm not a scientist. This is a picture, a photograph I took in Guilin, China some years ago. I'm going to take out the lens. You can't see that, but every bit of that picture is contained in every tiny part of that. I can hold the magnifying glass up here. I can put it over here. The entire picture, and in fact, if I... Let me see a piece of paper. If I put a piece of paper over part of this... piece of information. And to some extent, that's how the quantum holography works, that everything is contained there. You think about this, that as a number of scientists have said, I'll just cite David Bohm, who's Wholeness in the Implicate Order. The key feature of this hologram record is that each part contains information about the whole object, so that there's no point-to-point correspondence of object and recorded image. That is to say, the form and structure of the entire object may be said to be enfolded within each region of the photographic record. The capacity to process information about distant events appears to be a property of all physical and biologic organization and is likely due to non-local communication via coherent oscillations in the energy field that interconnects everything in the universe. Okay, a lot of technical scientific jargon, which I don't expect you to have gotten much out of because it's difficult to hear all of this and make sense of it. I think the important thing is that at least some of the theorists speculate that everything that has been said and thought and written and spoken exists in the quantum universe someplace. That if, in fact, Nephi said something to his wife, we would have it's someplace there. That things that are not now in our information environment can be made to be in our information environment if we had the ability to find it, to connect to it. So one of the things that I'm suggesting is that since we now suggest that, you know, there seems to be some evidence that what's happening on that level may also, if we have the right instrumentation, happen on this level in which we work, then there's possibility for people to have access to all of that information, any place in the world, in the history. In a paper on irony, the Book of Mormon, I delivered a couple of years ago at this symposium, I cited Drs. Gary Schwartz and Linda Russick, their study of the living energy universe. And in that one, I will just summarize that I believe that the very rigorous scientific studies that they've conducted indicate that it is possible to communicate across the veil, that they have what to me is compelling scientific evidence of that. I'm going to summarize so we have some time for questions and all. In summary, what I'm suggesting is that there exists a process or processes which, under certain circumstances we do not yet fully understand, but which seem validated by a growing body of scientific evidence, certain people may be able to access information previously unknown or even unknowable by conventional ways from both the past and the future. When Joseph Smith looked into his hat, he either manifests an astonishing, I would say miraculous, ability to compose and dictate extemporaneously a complex narrative that had elements unavailable in his information environment, or he had the ability somehow to access information from some source through some process that has to do with intuition, non-local communication, and information transfer across the liminal threshold that separates the physical and the spiritual worlds. To entertain such an idea requires, as Robert Nadeau and Menas Kaftos say, quote, a commitment to both metaphysical realism and epistemological realism. We don't think of those as somehow being possible together. This is a process which modern science seems to suggest is real, and it may also be a process which is similar to or parallel to that used by mystics, mediums, and channelers, as well as by prophets, seers, and revelators, and also by those whom Robert Nadeau calls poets of the new reality. All of this research might well open a new door to our understanding of how Joseph Smith could have produced a book as complex, structurally complicated, and linguistically rich as the Book of Mormon. Intuition, quantum holography, spirit communication. I don't mean to suggest in any way that such processes do not involve the Holy Ghost or that they are not spiritual. I firmly believe that such things happen not in violation of natural law, but through a higher and deeper manifestation of it. I am suggesting that ultimately we will come to see that the spiritual as well as the physical are part of the same system. That if, as Newton and his contemporaries believed, the purpose of science is to think God's thoughts after him, we must remember that they are, after all, God's thoughts, and that they can be ours as well. Alexander Pope said of Newton, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." I believe other deeper laws of nature were still hidden in night at the beginning of the 18th century when God said, "Let Joseph Smith be." And with what we call the first vision, more light began flooding into the world. In many ways, we are still in the dark. But I believe that Joseph Smith's revelatory announcement that, quote, spirit is nothing more than refined matter, as well as his expansive vision of the cosmos and the ultimate interconnectedness of things, anticipated some of the findings of this new science. I also believe that the book he produced is a likely product of some process we only now dimly comprehend, which may yet produce many more great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. Thank you.
Well, this response is a challenge for me. I am not a physicist. I am a behavioral scientist. Even many of my colleagues might question that assumption. Of course, speaking here at Sunstone, at best I'm a so-called behavioral scientist, so we're on tenuous ground here. Although I appreciate very much the effort and the lengths that Bob has gone to share this particular perspective in response to the naturalists who are engaged in, I guess, what we would call a full court press with their recent empirical scientific evidences about the race questions about the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I have always, for whatever reason, always been curious and intrigued by the question of how did Joseph Smith bring about the Book of Mormon. We've got the official history. We've got the tracts. I've even, read through detailed histories such as the history of Joseph Smith by his mother, where she walks through much greater detail in terms of the background of what transpired during those years when Joseph Smith was working with the family to get his hands on the golden plates and so on. Early on, I learned to speak Spanish and was always curious about the process of translation. How would this thing called the Urim and Thummim fit into it? What about the peepstone and the peering into the hat and all the rest? It's always been a point of intrigue and curiosity for me, which is to answer, how in the world did he do it? And so over all the years, as I've read and come across things here and there, I've always kept an eye out for that answer, and I still haven't come across it, at least in any way that that satisfies me. There are questions, clearly, that are raised and not addressed by the apologists, the true believers, who like to simply quote the official story. In some respects, they have clearly, over the decades, gotten themselves out onto a limb that they never should have gotten out onto in the first place, and so I don't want to say it's been fun, but it's been curious to watch a lot of the backpedaling the last few years by the apologists as they've been trying to retroactively retract things that they claim not to have said that simply can't stand up under scrutiny with the naturalists or the empirical scientists. Be that as it may, I'm still not persuaded that the empirical scientists can readily answer the questions for us as to how Joseph Smith did it. How did he put this book in our hands? And in some respects, I think it goes to the heart of the question, what does it mean to claim that the Book of Mormon is true? I have been rereading a few things that have been written by a New Testament historian named John Dominic Crossan, who many of you might know. He has gone to great lengths to point out what he understands to be the what people call the historical Jesus. And one of the things that struck me just recently when I was reading it, I think have a lot of parallels that can help us understand the argument between the apologists or the true believers in the official story and the naturalists or the empirical scientists who are arguing the empirical evidence to the contrary. And that is that the John Dominic Crossan, for example, when he talks about the miracles in the New Testament, he's very quick to point out the difference between healing an illness versus curing a disease. The difference, as he describes it, is that healing a disease is much like a microbiologist treats a bug. A microbiologist treats a bug by trying to eradicate the bug, and you thereby effect a cure of the disease. But what John Dominic tries to point out over and over again in his critique of the New Testament history and the Bible accounts of Jesus' healings is that Jesus was not at the level of operating as a microbiologist trying to cure disease. Jesus was trying to affect healings of an illness. An illness is much broader than that microscopic disease. The illness involves all of the social and cultural baggage that goes along with the disease, so that a leper had a social illness in addition to or despite whatever the microbiological disease of the particular medical cause of that illness was. And so I think a lot of times what we see now with the apologists and the naturalists is that they're talking past each other. The naturalists are much like the microbiologists at that microscopic level, where they are worried about trying to understand the bug that's causing the disease, if you will, whereas the apologists seem to be more interested in the overall healing of the illness. Now, I don't know if that analogy works for you or not, but it did for me. And also, the other thing that struck me in preparing Mark's for this presentation was again an appeal back to the original question, which is, what does it mean to claim that the Book of Mormon is true? Are we talking about, is it true at a microscopic level or at a social healing level, if we're to use that parallel? Now, clearly, as a missionary, and I've actually served a couple of missions for the church, including full-time mission, stake mission, all the rest, so I'm very familiar with Moroni 10:4. And that is, if you want to find out if the Book of Mormon is true, well, you read it and pray about it. Of course, my understanding is that Moroni 10:4 is not the only way, or indeed even the preferred way. We've got DNC 9, DNC 8, which says that you know, we need to study things out, and that the Lord reveals truth to us through our mind and through our spirit or our intuition. What is it, so when we talk about what does it mean to claim that the Book of Mormon is true, there are a lot of people who feel that confirmation or witness from the Spirit is all that you need. Now, why go any further? Well, for those of us who are more interested in understanding with our minds and our hearts, and not either one, that answer alone usually is not enough. And so then we can get into maybe pushing that question of how do we substantiate the claim that the Book of Mormon is true a little bit further, and we can get into the question of whether or not the process by which we received the Book of Mormon was inspired, whether it was just an invention of Joseph Smith's mind or the circumstances or what have you. There's the whole question of is the Book of Mormon true in the sense that it was inspired? At the end of the day, though, I think the most interesting and most meaningful question is whether or not, not so much whether it was inspired, but whether it is inspiring. Along those lines, I know Bob Reese actually shares this view as well, because he contributed a very eloquent essay in a book that Eugene England compiled a number of years ago called Book of Mormon Conversion Narratives, which was, in fact, was part of a series of ideas that Eugene developed to try to push us beyond the idea of doing theology and telling each other stories. Those kinds of conversion narratives, at least for me, are much more powerful in communicating the truth that the Book of Mormon is inspiring, much more so than whether it was inspired this way or that. Other things, such as Carolyn Pearson's essay on whether or not feminism could have saved the Nephites, for me is a much more inspiring examination and study of what the Book of Mormon has to tell us today than all the evidence that that's being presented about the submolecular DNA of the so-called Lamanites as they've officially been understood according to the official narrative today. There are also a variety of stories and accounts within the Book of Mormon alone that for me are particularly inspiring. But again, I get back to the question of what does it mean to claim that the Book of Mormon is true. Most of us are familiar with the story of Ammon and his brothers, and most of us know and understand the idea of Ammon as the fellow in the Book of Mormon who cut off all the arms of the well defending the king's flocks. But in fact, there's much more to the story of Ammon that gets overlooked for most of us in our Book of Mormon stories, and that is the account of Ammon when he runs into his brothers at the end of their mission. You recall this story, it's in Alma 26. Ammon gives himself over to boasting, and he's talking about how wonderful the success is that they had experienced on their mission. And then he reminds his brothers, you remember what everybody said to us back in Zarahemla before we left to go on our mission? And, of course, he has to remind him. In Alma 26, he specifically lays out what it is that he wanted his brothers to remember. And this is great, by the way, if you want some evidence for just how timely and current all these truths are in the Book of Mormon. Just bring this out in Sunday school when people start debating the nature of our foreign policy as a people and what we should do with those who choose to attack us in the United States. Point out to them that maybe there's a better way of responding to those who choose to hurt us than responding with the sword or the bomb or whatever the modern equivalent is. I almost got literally word for word the kind of reaction in a recent high priest group meeting I was in where they were in favor of military action today, citing that there was really no other alternative because the people we were fighting against had hearts that delighted in the shedding of blood, and that they were a stiff-necked people, and there was no other way to deal with them other than to wipe them off the face of the earth. So I pulled out Alma 26 and shared the following passage, where Ammon says to his brothers, do you remember when we left to come up among the Lamanites? Do you remember what everybody said to us? They said, do you suppose that you can bring the Lamanites to the knowledge of the truth? Do you suppose that you can convince the Lamanites of the incorrectness of the traditions of their fathers, as stiff-necked a people as they are, whose hearts delight in the shedding of blood, whose days are spent in the grossest iniquity, whose ways have been the ways of a transgressor from the beginning? Now, my brethren, you remember that this was their language? And moreover, they said, let us instead take up arms against them, that we may destroy them and their iniquity out of the land, lest they overrun us and destroy us. But behold, my brethren, we came into the wilderness, not with the intent to destroy our brethren, but with the intent that perhaps we might save some few of their souls. And if you you follow that up with the teachings of the Savior in the New Testament, I think it's clear what it is that should be expected of us, and that the lessons from the Book of Mormon can serve to inspire us along those lines. Dan, you want to go ahead and run the questions? Or? Yeah, all right, so thank you.
We have exactly 10 minutes for Q&A, so if you have a question, why don't you come up here and we'll hand you this mic so you get on the tape real quick. You first, then Joe second.
Hi, Bob. I, as much as anybody, would really like to accept and believe the premise that Bob's building on, and that this new research, this new line of research, might give us the answer to the question of how Joseph did translate the Book of Mormon. But I admit to being confused about all this. Radin, who's quoted here, has been largely discredited by people who are in the academic community, who are the hard scientists who look at this kind of research and see it as too woo-woo-ish to believe in. That doesn't mean that it is woo-woo-ish, but that's where the scientific community is today. One of the interesting things about this and the quantum mechanics part is that Richard Feynman, who is a well-known world-class physicist who died a few years ago, was asked to teach a course in quantum mechanics, and he said no because he didn't know enough about it. And the fact is, we don't know enough about quantum mechanics. It's mysterious. It has a lot of questions that remain unanswered. So my question and thought is this. Isn't it equally as likely as we pursue this line of research, which I agree needs to be pursued and is producing some interesting evidence, that at the end of that we might just as likely find out that the Book of Mormon is inspired fiction based on the way the brain works and the heart works and connections to things that are out there, as that there really was a Nephi that he's somehow collecting from this data that's somewhere out in the universe? I wonder if you'd have some thoughts about that, since we're in a world of probabilities and we really don't know.
Yeah, one of the things I would say, thanks, Larry, about the research of the Institute where I work that has been published in some of the leading journals, and there's always this question, going back to something that Mike said about the naturalists accept empirical evidence. Well, they accept the empirical evidence that fits their argument and their line of reasoning, but there's a lot of empirical evidence, I think, as a textual critic, that they ignore. So we all do that, of course. We select those things that confirm our own beliefs. This, you know, this is highly speculative kinds of stuff. I don't know. What I do know is that the university sometimes is the least likely place one is likely to find truth, and you and I both spent our professional careers in the university, and the closed-mindedness to a lot of things. I am respectful of the dialogue that has to take place. But if we go back 100 years, so much of what we now know is true about quantum mechanics and about quantum physics and quantum holography, nobody would have believed. It was, to them, as fantastic as anything could have been in terms of science fiction. And so we don't know, and I don't know how the material God in Joseph Smith's mind, whether it happened in some form different than what I'm proposing, and I'm only suggesting this as a tentative thing to consider. I think the new science is intriguing in terms of what it suggests, not in terms of what it proves or the preponderance of evidence that it leaves us with, but only that it opens our mind to other considerations. Because right now we seem to be locked in this pitched battle between the people who say we're empiricists and we only accept the hard evidence, and other people who say, well, we are believers, we accept this evidence. And I find myself wanting those people to stop shouting and start talking to one another. And so part of this is to say, you know, let's think about whether or not there's some other ways to think about the question. But ultimately, it may lead us down some paths that nobody even now has imagined. I don't know. But it's to keep pursuing the path, to keep asking the questions, not to be rigidified or locked in our positions that ultimately, it seems to me, don't lead us any place. Yes, question here.
Hi, Bob. I'm Joe Jepson.
I know you, Joe. You rabble-rousing troublemaker.
I won't talk to you about quantum mechanics or Schrodinger's cat or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle or the parallel universes. But my father was walking along one day behind Russell Nelson, and he put his hand on Russell Nelson's shoulder and he said, "You're going to be the next apostle." And Russell Nelson told that story all over Salt Lake and also at my father's funeral, and said that he must have been inspired to know that. But when he said that, why, I asked my father how he knew that, and he said, well, you know, my sister's married to Maury Taylor, and Maury Taylor's the head physician for the Beneficial Life, and he hobnobs with the general authorities, and he heard them say that, so I said that to Russell Nell. So everything that we don't know that was in the mind of Joseph Smith, why, I admit that some of those things are mysteries that we don't know. When Harold Bloom wrote his American Religion, he was amazed at some of the Jewish thoughts that Joseph Smith had. And he didn't realize that in the School of the Prophets he had a Jewish savant there talking to him all the time. In the last dialogue magazine. I think that's the name of the magazine. I'm just saying that because I was one of the founders. David Wright of Brandeis University reviewed a book for which some guy got excommunicated, I think, on some of the shortcomings of the Book of Mormon. And Wright says, well, I have in my mind 12 categories of evidence that shows that the Book of Mormon is not of ancient origin. 12 categories, and this guy only reviews 7 of them. He says, so I think that the book is inadequate in that it doesn't cover all the categories of the inadequacies, all the 12 categories to show that the Book of Mormon isn't of ancient origin, blah, 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 blah. But what I wonder about is that in a symposium like this, we don't have somebody review the 12 categories instead of talking to us about items that might be in Joseph Smith's mind that we can't explain, but maybe they can be explained by knowing that Maury Taylor was the Beneficial Life's physician. But I'll ask you a mundane question. Why did they need plates if they could look in a hat for the translation?
First of all, it's nice to know that Rustin Kaufman is alive and well and still causing trouble. One of the things, by the way, you mentioned Harold Bloom. Harold Bloom could not explain and was mystified by Joseph Smith's understanding of some of the Enoch material. He couldn't explain, even by Joseph Smith's access to Hebrew teachers, how he seemed to have intuited things about Enoch that were not in the information environment. I can't explain the question, except I would say this, that if somebody is going to perpetuate a fraud and wants to convince people that he's receiving some divine wisdom from above, the last thing he'll do is look in some dumb hat. I mean, that just seems to me crazy to think that people are going to believe if you look in a hat, you're going to find something in there besides the bottom of the hat. So I don't know. I do believe that there are things that we know, things that happen that can't be explained by the laws that we currently understand, Carol Lynn's serendipity principles. I was just reading something in either David Bohm or someone the other day about serendipity being part of this whole thing and how those things that we think are suddenly our accidents may not be. I don't know. I'm just wanting us to be open to possibilities. That the more we are open to the things that we don't understand, the more we may understand. I can't explain all of these things about the Book of Mormon, but I go back to the fact that I think there's a lot of things in the Book of Mormon that no empirical science has yet found an answer for. I think there are things that the empiricists are finding that some of the apologists don't have an answer for. That's okay. I think as long as we keep open the possibility that by having a respectful dialogue, by being open to those possibilities, that we may have a better chance of finding truth than by calling each other names across the chasm. And there may be 12. I know I have a great deal of respect for Wright and for his thinking. He may have 12 or 24 categories that were not satisfied by Palmer. Apologists may have that many that they don't feel are satisfied by the other. Let's keep talking. That's the main thing.
Time is up, so we'll officially close the session, but let's go ahead and kind of continue the conversation.
Okay.
Thank you to these guys.
I apologize for the fact this was a highly technical paper, one, and two, I don't know what I'm talking about. Yes, John.
Well, my question is this. You know, we've been talking about paranormal means of channeling the Book of Mormon or receiving the Book of Mormon. And I don't know if it's an overly simplistic mind that needs to reconcile something with the actual official historicity and the church's official story of the Book of Mormon, but does channeling or receiving in a paranormal way, you know, the Book of Mormon, does that need to be reconciled with the actual premise of the history of the Americas and the church's official stance on the veracity of Lamanites and that actual peopling of the Americas from Israel, or does it just, or is the Book of Mormon proposed to be able to exist independently as a meaningful kind of story?
Good question. One of the things that I, if you've read Blake Osler's look at the DNA, which I find interesting and provocative, you would come to the conclusion that we don't yet have the full picture on DNA. I think it's pretty clear that what the church has been saying, not I think by way of deception, but by way of tradition, that is, I think it was natural for Joseph Smith to assume certain things about who the Indians were without him trying to convince us they were something that he didn't believe they were. But it seems pretty clear to me that the DNA evidence is not showing up what we had expected it to. But then what does that mean? I don't know. I don't know if it will say, wow, there's nothing here and this is all a fabrication, or whether, what one of the things we do know is that the last word on science, that is, the history of science is a history of people who were open to the challenging the axioms of science. And again, the history of science suggests that we have to continue doing that. The history of religion should also be a history of challenging the axioms of religion and of belief. And I am fond of saying I distrust two kinds of Mormons, those who never think and those who only think. And it is the process of thinking and feeling and weighing and having both that dialogue with ourselves and the dialogue with one another and the dialogue with God that I think we may have the best chance of coming to some idea of whatever the truth may ultimately be. Thank you very much.